The devastating flash floods on Kauai back in April triggered the Garden Isle's mayor to institute emergency measures that included a ban on vacation rentals in the flood-ravaged areas. Life has not returned to normal in the Hanalei area. Access is still a problem. Mayor Bernard Carvalho joined us in the studios this morning to talk about his plan to speed up recovery on the island.
Right now, there is access only for residents. And I know our TVR community, we'll call it that, also obviously is at the forefront right now, wanting to see how quickly, because it's about business and all that, which is okay. But for me, it's about safety first. And so what we are trying to do right now is I did meet with our TVR leaders in my office. And we sat and I said, we are in need of helping our families who are still displaced because of the damages to their homes. These are families that are registered families who lost their homes. And we're trying to see if we can work together in placing these families within the TVRs for now. And we, with the resources that we have now, that coming funding-wise, we'll be able to actually pay not the full amount, but a portion of the amount for them to stay there while their homes are being repaired. To me, it's a win-win for TVR because we cannot, I cannot as mayor, because of safety reasons and because of where we are right now, allow anyone else to enter this area until we're safe. And so that's the big part. I wanted our families to be able to get to the store, get to the doctor, get to school, get their immediate needs done and go back home. The ones who can. The ones who've been displaced, let's make a win-win with the TVR community. And so we've had the discussion. They're open to that. TVR, the community, the business side of it is important within the visitor destination area. And that is a big part. Yes.
And we're talking licensed.
Licensed, yes. I want you to get licensed vacation rentals. Yeah.
And so how many do we have and how many families are displaced?
Okay, so right now within the Hanalei area, we have almost 20 plus families, you know, and some are staying at the beaches. Some are staying multiple places. And we've sat with them, we meaning our team, boots on the ground. Assess the families that are in need. And imagine now if they can actually stay in these vacation rentals that are vacant. And if it stays for $1,000 a month, we can pay $500. Or $1,500, you know, we pay half. But there's funding available to help support this effort. And we'll make sure that the TVR is, of course, the business side. When we do open up, we'll bring it back to whatever standards. But to me, that's important right now. And so I'm hoping that after that discussion with our key leaders in that community, they're coming back, and I'm hoping that we can get some good results on that.
Okay, and then how about the funding? Because the state did open up, a whole avenue for aid.
Right. So thank God, with working with our legislative team and our just all of our leaders, the state set aside $100,000, right, for us. And so we're setting aside that, and we're working closely. We already got 25 of that. And so we're working very, very closely to assure that the funding is set aside.
And what about the damage to the roadways and all the other infrastructure?
So, you know, the damage, again, the state is taking care of that portion. We're keeping in contact every step of the way. It's been kind of challenging up until now recently, where they may change that convoy times, because there's certain times that our families can go in and out, and there's a business side. But as we get closer to completing the roadways, it may have us to, we may have to close it at a longer period of time, so it might eliminate access for a full day or the weekends. So we're kind of sorting through that. I don't want that to happen, so we want to make sure we work with the community first. But we want to get it done, and I'm told by the state that by October, the work should be done. But as we get closer, what does it mean to the people? See, and that's my concern. And so how do we really engage the people side so they can continue to get services that they need and they're not totally left abandoned from being going in and out? The funding, again, is there. We got federal funds for public safety. We got federal funds now. The president signed recently for individual assistance, meaning that the families who have got damages to their homes have up to $34,000 that would be accessible to them. But they have to show their paperwork and their, you know, assessments have to be submitted. And we did open two disaster relief areas, one in Kaloa, in the Kapaa area, sharing. But we recently had to close that. Why? Because a lot of the families weren't coming to the center. So what we said, I said, well, we're going to go to them. So we have our FEMA team and our team's boots on the ground again. What happened? They're going house to house now. And sure enough, a lot of them are being able to get their assessments done and qualifying for some help in their homes.
You have a good bird's eye view on all the other issues. I know there's the question of access and maybe also the access to recreational areas, on that side. Also with the agriculture, the impact on our farmers.
Our farmers, especially our taro farmers, Rodney Haraguchi folks. And so, in fact, we just talked about that. You know, we are assembling a solid team. We're finding that, God forbid something happens again, that where we need to be is really doing a better job at cleaning or restoring our streams and rivers and bridges. That's where it's at. And as you begin at the river mouth and work your way from Makai Mauka, it kind of gets narrow, narrow, narrow. And so we're finding that obviously that's what caused a lot of the damage to our farmers, because we're not maintaining our streams and rivers the way it should be. So we assembled a team made up of county, state, and federal, working closely with the governor's office and our office to really address the stream restoration program. So we're just about ready to go with FEMA up and assessing the stream areas from, like I said, starting at the River Mart area, which is wider. And what we found is as we go Mauka, we have some Hawaiian, well, I'm going to say groups and organizations who are willing to do a stewardship agreement. And they're willing to actually manage the upper portion of the rivers, where they would come in with their sickles, the old style, instead of these big machines. And they're willing to take a portion of the upper part of the river and manage that because of culture, because of the need to take care of our aina, because of the need to take care of the fish and the o'opu and all that in the streams. So we have opportunities with federal, state, county, private, and then stewardship.
Right.
See, so it's a mix of people managing this one river example. I'm looking at all rivers, but one river and taking responsibility together in assuring that we can manage it. We can clear the berms. We can clear the shrubbery. We can make sure that the silt is removed, because we found, I walked in, I talked to the families. If that area was cleared, the water wouldn't have diverted to his home or eroded their property, because it could flow. So remember now, this is the worst in the nation, 50 plus inches of rain in a 24-hour period. Oh my God, that was like the worst. So we know it, we feel it, I understand it. So now is the time. And the rivers and streams, because we're island setting, so we got to make sure we manage that. And we're really ready to go. We got the funding, we got the support, we got the state, county together working hand in hand. And we want to set that footprint for all rivers and streams.
So it's a shared kuleana, really.
Totally. At the beginning, I'm going to say this, it's kind of everybody pointing fingers. Oh, it's not my bridge. Oh, I'm responsible for the bridge, but not the water. What? We together. So as mayor, wanted to offer the lead, if you will, in our island, and being able to really communicate. I want my public works engineers working with the state engineers. I want our planning guys working with our state planning guys, and developing relationships around the table so they can count on each other. DLNR, DHHL, DOBAR, all the agencies working with our public works engineers, all of them working at the table. That, to me, will be a better result, because we're all on the same page. And to me, that's what we need right now.
So we need to be able to marshal the forces and deal with the immediate needs of the residents first, going back to the TBRs. And then what other areas can we look at to prevent this from happening again?
Well, I think for now would be that. And then at the same time, we don't know what kind of disaster. We've been through hurricanes, or God forbid, all of our brothers and sisters on the Big Island during the lava. But we're coming with a solid footprint, and no matter what happened, what island, we all can share the information, how to assure that we are ready, we are prepared, we have the paperwork, we have the format. What we added in our emergency operating center this year that nobody else has is our planning department. And the planning department is the guys that does the GPS and the GIS. They can hone in on the properties using technology now, because they weren't part of the operating centers team, and we included planning, because planning can actually visually see through technology the various properties that are damaged or where we need to go. So that's another big add to our emergency management operations, our internal operations.
And while we have you here at the table, we have been having discussions about Airbnb, you know, and the vacation rentals and the issue of over-tourism. You know, I don't know. What's your sense? Do you see a need to open up maybe additional vacation rentals in that area once we get back to normal?
Oh, see, once we get back to normal, we're open for. I mean, you know, we're open for business now. We want people to come to Hawaii. We don't want people to stay away. Just for now, you can't go to this side of the island, but you can go this side. And yes, now is the time, and we're working collectively with our Visitors Bureau, HLTA, HTA, our Kauai Visitors Bureau. We have a Parks Master Plan, the Haina Parks Master Plan, which was just approved. So that's a big part. So all of this is happening now, and now is the time to incorporate the people into the plan and ask them, what do you think? Because we have time now to really do a better job at managing the roadways, managing parking. The future of Hanalei, you know, the future is you're going to go on a shuttle. A shuttle will take you down into Hanalei in the future. That's we want to do a holo-holo shuttle kind of thing where we're going to move our people. We did a pilot project last year within this particular area, the Hanalei area. And guess what? 51% of the ridership was local people. What? Jumping on a shuttle to go to work. So it's a it's a win-win. We tried it. There were some funding issues, but now is the time. I'm saying to our guys, we are going to create this shuttle that's going to take people from Princeville, park and ride, down into Hanalei. And that's how you can get to work. You can visit our beautiful part of the North Shore and at the same time travel the North Shore with aloha. And then that's the future that we're talking about right now. We got the funding for that too now.
Okay, so the all new solutions to some of these problems of over-congestion, whether it be on the roadways, in our parks.
Even like a Haena Beach Park was totally, Waioli Road was totally washed out. So we had to redo that. So that part of the Parks Master Plan, so we're addressing that as well. We got the funding. We're going to move the restrooms. We're going to open up some other. We got to look at this as an opportunity to make things right, as an opportunity to look at where the water flowed here and didn't flow here, make sure we adjust that. And I'm saying when you go into emergency situations when repair and maintenance, you go back to pre-disaster state. And I'm saying, if you're telling me I got to put the bridge back to the same way, why can't we enhance the bridge? How do we work to make it wider? How do we work to make it safer instead of just going pre? So we're adding on before we do the work. We're making sure we look at that project and include every single opportunity to assure that, God forbid, something happens next time, that we're safe and we're solid. And that's the kinds of thinking that has to be incorporated when we look at each individual area that has been hit and devastated. Farming, again, is another one. I want to talk about that just briefly because, God, we may not have any poi next year. And that's, I can't handle that.
A lot of people can't handle that.
Life without poi. Yeah. So how do we help our farmers? And so we really look at the SBA loans, looking at, but the stream, like I said, is the one to hit it now because then the water would flow where it should flow. And at the same time, helping them to come back as soon as best as can.
Right, but all about doing a better job of managing our resources.
Managing our resources, and starting with the water, the land, the aina, and incorporating the thoughts and ideas of our people who live there. And then we as leaders incorporate that into the bigger plan. And then we're not going pre-disaster. We're going repair this particular area, but we're going to enhance it. We're asking for patience and understanding, but at the forefront as mayor, it's all about safety. And so I will not allow any traffic or whatever to happen until it's safe. And that's where we're at.
Thank you, Mayor, for your time. We really appreciate you being in studio.
Thank you so much. Aloha and mahalo.
That was Mayor Bernard Carvalho talking about Kauai's recovery from the recent floods. You can listen back to this interview on our podcast page. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, star-crossed lovers in 1920s Hawaii. But first, your quiz.
For today's quiz, we'll be traveling to the Captain Cook Monument on Hawaii Island. Located just north of Pu'uhonua o Honaunau, Kealakekua Bay has had a lively and often brutal history. Captain James Cook docked his two ships, the Resolution and the Discovery, in Kealakekua Bay in January of 1779, marking the first recorded encounter between Europeans and Native Hawaiians. Though Cook and his crew were originally welcome in Kealakekua Bay, mounting tensions between the two groups culminated in the death of Cook and many Native Hawaiians. Today, the Captain Cook Monument sits on the north side of Kealakekua Bay and serves as a stark reminder of the bay's violent history. But the Captain Cook Monument wasn't built until nearly 100 years after Captain Cook's death in 1874. For today's quiz, who commissioned the construction of the Captain Cook Monument in Kealakekua Bay? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Laura Thielen. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Plantation society, so often romanticized when we look at Hawaii's past, was governed by strict class distinctions, and it's that rigidly stratified society in 1920s Hawaii Island that forms the background of the new movie Running for Grace. David Cunningham, who grew up on Hawaii Island, is the director. It's a story of young star-crossed lovers, and David is on the phone from Kona. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I just looked at some previews for your movie, and one of the things that will stand out to audiences about it is the spectacularly beautiful locales you've chosen.
Yeah, we have so much to celebrate visually in Hawaii, and it was a thrill to be able to make a movie in my backyard with some incredible locations, many of which is in the area that your quiz was just talking about, up Kealakekua side, mm-hmm. in the Kona Coffee Belt. So that was one of our main locations.
And is that where you grew up?
I grew up closer to town. I lived up there for a little while, but was more down in closer to Kona side. But I went to high school up there, Kona Waena High School, right there in the Coffee Belt. And we have about four generations on island, and this is home.
Well, your movie goes right at the whole idea of the class distinctions in society back then. What made that important to you?
Well, when we were doing some research in the 20s, Hawaii was highly segregated. You know, today we're the melting pot, but as you mentioned earlier, people forget what it was like before, where the various ethnicities were intentionally separated for controlling purposes so that they wouldn't unionize and so on. Mm-hmm. And there was a federal law that included the territory of Hawaii, which in our film takes place in 1920s, in which it was actually illegal to adopt children of mixed ethnicity. And they talked about it as being for racial integrity. And that is mind-blowing to us in Hawaii today, mm-hmm. with so much mix. And that was fascinating to me. And we basically wrote this script set in that world about an orphan boy who's Hapa, half Japanese, half Haole, and he's rejected by both communities. And a plantation owner, a plantation doctor, a new doctor who answers an ad, who's clueless about Hawaii, played by Matt Dillon, comes to the plantation and takes the boy under his wing and kind of becomes a de facto father figure. And the boy helps run medicine up the mountains to the plantation pickers. And then a forbidden romance evolves and so on.
Well, it's very clear when you see the boy and the girl in the movie that there's quite a natural, you know, they're having nature's reaction to one another that would happen no matter who or what part of society either came from, that's, you know, it's kind of their humanity drives them toward each other.
But, exactly.
But society doesn't like it very much, does it?
No, we have, she's the daughter of the plantation owner, and he is one of the major leaders in the community and controls a lot of the economy. And this could undermine their position in many ways. I won't give too much of the film. But there's a competition when a doctor comes to town, played by Jim Caviezel, who has a newfangled contraption called a Ford Model T. And he gets to drive to his patients, while as Matt Dillon's character, they have to hump up and walk everywhere because they're serving the immigrant pickers, and Caviezel's character is serving the higher pedigree, and so there's a fun kind of competition, and at the same time, I think a whole aspect of Hawaii's immigration story that maybe a lot of people aren't aware of.
It's immigration stories are taking on a new relevance these days, aren't they, David?
Yes, absolutely.
And as you said, you know, Hawaii is now seen as a melting pot. Do you think people will be, which it may or may not be, right? But do you think people will be surprised by the depiction of this rigidly stratified society?
I think so. I think, you know, our memories are short, and I think it's important to revisit. And the Japanese immigrant forms such a major part of who Hawaii is today. You know, some of the banks here on the Big Island were founded by the Japanese coffee farmers because no one would loan them money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pooled their own funds together and were able to start expanding. And the whole coffee industry was one of the ways to be an entrepreneur during the plantation era, when people would want to get out of the sugarcane industry, which was so physically demanding and humiliating in many ways. A Japanese farmer could buy 5 acres and start their own place and provide for their family. So coffee has a very different past than some of the other agricultural industries at the time.
In a way, it was an avenue that was open to say, Japanese farmers that wouldn't have been open in sugar or pineapple?
Yeah, exactly, because you didn't need as big of a plot. It didn't have to be all soil and dirt. Coffee grows in rock or thin soil, and it has to be at a certain elevation, but a lot of that was cheap land at the time. And so our story takes place in the middle of that transition between the plantation owners and the immigrants being able to start their own way of life, not just be controlled by others.
Do you think it's important, David, to do what you've done in your movie, which is to, you know, maybe add heft to the movie by setting a boy-girl romance in amid a situation that's kind of social and political?
Yes, you know, romance is a universal, you know, connection to the audience, and we wanted this to be a entertaining movie. Not only is it educational, but we wanted it to be inspirational. And this is a movie that we intentionally made for the whole family. You know, my original intention was inspired by my experience as a father with three kids and my wife wrestling over the remote every night going, who's going to watch what they want to watch? And I thought, man, wouldn't it be great if there was a show that we all wanted to see, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of my original intents in setting out on this movie.
There aren't that many shows like that being made anymore. And what do you think's the reason for that?
Well, you know, we're in a major upheaval and change in the entertainment industry. I've been doing this a while. This is my eighth movie to make, and filmed in 50 countries and docs and all kinds of stuff. And with the evolution of places like Netflix and Amazon streaming, it's an exciting time because there's more content needed than ever. And if you're in the content creation business, that's great. But it's upended a lot of the models that have worked in the past. And right now, the independent film model is getting hit pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult for the indie filmmakers to get their movies out there. And especially now that Netflix has switched over from acquiring movies to making their own. And we are very lucky that we were able to get a global release with this movie and get in theaters. It's really tough out there. So that's really playing a lot. And then, you know, companies like Disney, who will soon have about a 40% market share after they acquire Fox, are really sucking up a lot of that bandwidth as well. And
well,
basically with the big, huge budget movies.
Let's hope there's room for the indies to survive. David, thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes, well, thank you for having me. And please tell everybody, let's hit the movies this Friday.
Sounds good. They're
playing
air conditioned, right?
Dole Cannery.
David L. Cunningham is the director of the new movie Running for Grace. It opens July 20th on Oahu at Dole Cannery and across the state. The Hawaii Public Housing Authority has agreed to comply with a federal order to improve accessibility standards at the living units it manages, even as its leader is pushing back at the order by saying, quote, nothing positive came out of their complaint. Anita Hofschneider has that story in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What's at issue here? The disability access in public housing? Is that the goal of all this?
Exactly. You know, this started a couple years ago when the Disability Rights Center of Hawaii asked the question of whether the State Public Housing Authority had enough units for disabled people. They thought the answer was no, and so they filed a complaint with HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and now what's happened is that this has been resolved, and HPHA, the Hawaii Public Housing Authority, has agreed to comply with a settlement that essentially will have all of these units upgraded within the next 3 years.
Agreed to comply, not without a certain amount of grumbling.
Exactly. You know, this is essentially an administrative settlement. So this was an investigation by HUD and subsequent negotiations that happened, you know, between HUD, the Hawaii Disability Rights Center, and HPHA. So there's no court case involved. But it's basically a settlement where they've said, you know, we haven't done anything wrong. We disagree with the allegations, but we want to comply in order to save taxpayer money and avoid a long, drawn-out court case.
The difference being, is this a difference between state and federal standards? What's different about these? What's the difference in here?
Well, the executive director of HPHA says that their units are up to code, and the problem is that HUD used the wrong standard to evaluate them. He says that they used American Disabilities Act 2010 codes and that they're allowed to do so. He sent me, actually, a federal law that says they're allowed to do so. But in the when HUD investigators came from California to evaluate the units and survey the units a year or so ago, they found many deficiencies, but were using a different standard for disability accessibility. And so Hakeem Ansafi, who leads the HPHA, says that what happened here was, you know, they're being basically being judged on a different standards from which they're already currently complying. And the upgrades that they're agreeing to do through this settlement are upgrades they were already planning to do. The settlement also requires them to survey their units, and he said that they're already planning to do so. And so his contention is that this complaint filed by the Disability Rights Center actually just served to delay what they were already planning to do.
Well, one of the things that happens in a process like this is the surveys and investigations that you're talking about, those aren't repairs, right? They simply identify the problem, where it is, what the nature of the problem is, but that's not getting anything fixed. I think that's part of the argument here.
So HPHA will have to engage in some surveys in the next 6 months following this agreement that was just signed a week or so ago. And after that, we'll get a much clearer sense of what is the state of Hawaii's public housing stock with regard to accessibility. And then they will be on a very strict plan that HUD will help monitor and regulate. And over the next 3 years, we will actually see some more upgrades to both the common areas as well as individual units. But, you know, as you've noted, HPHA's director maintains that these already were planned and that he's simply agreeing to sign the settlement but was already planning to do so, do these types of improvements with or without the settlement.
Well, I guess bottom line is just hoping the improvements get made. Thanks very much, Anita.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Anita Hofschneider. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
In news from the Big Island, officials report a large volcanic explosion at the Kilauea summit early this morning. They're also preparing for the lava flow to consume Pohoiki Boat Ramp and the Isaac Hale Park in the days to come. Such is the activity as Madame Pele continues to affect air quality for our state. This week we checked in with an organic farm about the impact to its crops and farm workers. Tane Dotta has been farming for 30 years. His family farm, Adaptations, is located in Kona. He tells us with the Vogue, it's all about patience.
I think when the eruption moved over to Lani and went away from the summit, then our air became more variable because sometimes the smoke would blow on the other side of the mountains and sometimes it would blow past us. So that's how the Vogue has been going. How it affects us is two ways. I think the most important way is the people. So the people, I work my farm and I have people who help me. And if our air gets to be up in the unhealthy range, it starts getting above 120. At some points it got above 150. Then you're low on energy, your decision-making is kind of poor. And what we were doing was doing the minimum. We decided for ourselves that we'd do what needed to be done, but not push new projects and try and get extra done. And then we have good days, we kind of jump ahead and do a little bit more. Everyone's excited. Everyone's kind of like, oh, good, we can see the sky again. And there's just be, you know, you'd be clearer thinking and have more energy.
And of the crops that you grow, what seems to be more susceptible?
The fastest things we grow and we pay a lot of attention to is the micro-mix, which is basically between a 1 week to a 3 week crop. And what we're seeing in there is basically pulses. When we have really heavy fog, then everything's really slow. And then we have a good day, it almost doubles up and jumps really quickly. So we have kind of an uneven growth pattern in there.
So when you're talking micro mix, you're talking a mix of greens?
Yeah, a mix of greens, basically seedlings. So we're able to see what it seems to happen is when the fog's heavy, we're not getting the right type of light that we're supposed to have. And so the plants kind of stagnate. And kind of almost no matter where they are, they stop in the middle and kind of just flounder for a while. For microgreens, it's not that big a deal. For the avocados and the fruit trees, we have avocados that are going off, and the tree would start to be ripe and start harvesting it, and all of a sudden it would stop. And when it stops in the middle of its ripening process, then what we were harvesting would start to go downhill, like it would be kind of, I don't know, get brown on one end or start getting stringier. And I think it was because it didn't quite get to the full ripening stage it was supposed to on the tree. It just kind of stalled.
We were hearing some stories about how, the avocados would get, they'd be very small and they wouldn't really ripen.
Right. They kind of get stuck. And then when they have a good day, I think they kind of jump ahead. So with a fruit, it's only got a short time period to be in that cycle on the tree. And we're growing greens like choy. We're growing a micromix. We do edible flowers, too. All those can kind of stall and come back again. It's not going to affect it as much as a fruit is, because there's a set of ripening processes that would have to happen on an avocado.
And we were talking with some of the researchers up at the University of Hawaii, and they were saying that coffee seemed to be fairly resilient. I know down like in the Kau area, they seem to be maintaining okay.
I also have a one-acre coffee farm, which is also about 1,500 feet, and it's over in the Captain Cook area. And I'm watching that too, and I think because it's got a long season before it has to turn red, it varies every year anyhow, depending on how much rainfall we have. So sometimes the rains will come early in the year and flush out a whole lot of flowers, and then you have some coffee, then you have another rainstorm like maybe 2 weeks later, and you have your next flush. So the coffee tree, I think, is used to having several flushes on it and several cycles at one time. And it seems like they're doing okay. You kind of won't know to the end of the year if there's diseases or misshapen beans or not. But as a whole, they seem to be doing okay.
So the other crops that you grow then a bit more fragile, and it's your expectation that the yields are going to be a lot smaller this time around?
Not necessarily, because what we're doing in the meantime is we're taking really good care of the plants. So they're well set up. We've kept pests off of them, and they have the fertilizer they're supposed to have on them. And so when we do have the little burst of the air gets good again, the air quality drops down all the way down, the particle matter drops down to zero or down to 50, basically in the green, then we see them growing really fast. They're almost like making up for lost time. They grow faster than I would expect them to grow. So with those type of crops, that would be kales and choys, they seem to be more or less, they're okay stalling. They still taste good. It's mostly that pulsing. And then again, as I said, the second thing that's actually equally important is the ability to work on the land is lower. Like when it's bad air, it's somewhat dangerous to work. It says unhealthy, and you don't want to get all those particles like really deep into your lungs. And I have to recognize that for myself and for the other people working with me. So I think that means that we lower the amount of labor on the farm. And I guess that's one thing. And the other thing is the avocados are the ones that I have the most, I'm kind of watching the most. And I'm probably getting reasonable yields off of the greens.
And how would you compare this challenge with the VOG with, some of the other pests and the issues that you have to deal with?
As a whole, we don't have a lot of pests. And we've been organic for a while, so we've kind of gotten ourselves into balance. And I think we haven't had the VOG this heavy before, but now it's kind of tapering off. So I guess, we were more concerned earlier about a drought. There's supposed to be some correlation that if we have a lot of particles in the air, then we're not getting the rains that we're used to. And that could be true this year. It's a little hard to say because there's so many other things affecting the climate at the moment. I'd say as a whole, droughts or winds would probably cause more damage than the VOG is right now. The VOG is kind of a waiting game.
You also grow medicinal plants.
In some ways, a lot of the reason the plants are medicinal is they are a little bit longer term, and they're able to deal with stress. So if they're getting stressed by some of this, for all I know, they might actually come out stronger because they're going to put up their defense systems too. So with Boticola and passion vine seem to be doing okay. We're watching nice flowering. Kava is a multi-year plant. I think it's going to do okay. Important that we are getting at least some pulses of clean air. And I do think it's important that it's trending down. So it's kind of something you have to kind of hunker down and just, kind of hopefully wait till it passes.
Okay.
So I guess it's patience.
Okay.
You have to have patience with it, and it really isn't besides making sure the plant has what it needs, is there anything else you can really do about it?
That was Tane Data, a Big Island organic farmer, sharing his story about coping with the effects of VOG on his crops. It's all about staying hydrated, good advice for both people and plants. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 14th Annual Hawaii Performing Arts Festival, presenting Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, tomorrow in Waimea and this Saturday in Hilo. HawaiiPerformingArtsFestival.org.
Earlier in the show, we asked you who commissioned the Captain Cook Monument in Kealakekua Bay. Captain Cook is a controversial figure in the history of Hawaii, and his monument is no exception. It may come as a surprise that a member of the Hawaiian royal family commissioned that Captain Cook Monument. Princess Likelike, sister to the two final monarchs of the Hawaiian kingdom, ordered the monument to be constructed in 1874 with the following inscription: "In memory of Captain James Cook, R.N., who discovered these islands on the 18th of January, Anno Domini 1778, and fell near this spot on the 14th of February, A.D. 1779. That's today's quiz. Nobody got that today, but if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. The story of Orpheus and Eurydice, separated by her death on their wedding day and reunited all too briefly by the power of his music, is usually told from the male point of view. But when it's reimagined as the story of Eurydice, consigned to the underworld and reunited there with her father, the familiar story takes on a new dimension. Producer and actor Paul Mitri is bringing the Sarah Rule play to the Paul and Vailu Theater stage this weekend, courtesy of his All the World's a Stage Theater Company, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Why this play?
Oh, well, there are probably a lot of reasons. One is it is a beautiful, beautiful poetic, a visual poem, and I do believe that, you know, right now in our society, it'd just be nice to have some beauty. Another thing is the director, Alex Monroe, brought this as a pet project. To him, it's a play about saying goodbye. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity for us to kind of say goodbye to some people that we have worked with as they move on to other parts of their career. Rachel Ueno, who plays Eurydice, is off to the mainland. She just got her MFA in acting. Jeff Brackett is going to go study acting in New York. Christina Sutroff, who did our lights and set, she's also moving to New York. So some of these people we've been working with really for a very long time. I think this is my 15th show with Rachel, and so it's a chance to say goodbye for us as well. But the story is just it is an abstract masterpiece.
The parting in the story is the parting of Orpheus and Eurydice married, and she promptly dies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's distraught. Usually it's all about Orpheus, the sensitive musician.
Right.
With his music, he draws her, gets a chance to bring her back from the underworld,
mm-hmm.
a chance
mm-hmm.
he sort of blows by returning and don't look at me, right?
Yeah, it is. In this version, you could interpret it, excuse me, you could interpret it as, does she kind of make him turn around? Mm-hmm. Does she really want to go? This one adds in the character of the father who is in the underworld, and their reunion in that place kind of creates even more humanity than perhaps she had in the regular world.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some kind of question about the interpretation. Does she really want to leave her father? Is Orpheus kind of, you know, this amazing love that she should definitely go back for?
Yeah.
It's
always been assumed that she was just dying, you should pardon the expression, mm-hmm. to get out of the underworld.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In this case, it isn't a horrible place, I guess. I mean, the idea that Alex is really trying to get across is that memories make us human. And so the memories that they share and that the father gets her to remember are just so touching.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her to leave that, it is hard. It isn't just, I gotta get out of here.
Well, in reading about the play, the phrase half in love with easeful death came up into my mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, life's a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's over, do you want to return to all that hassle?
Right.
I don't know if that figures into all this.
But. Oh, I think probably from Eurydice's standpoint, you know, where would you rather be with somebody that takes care of you, that you know, it's just easy to be with?
Yeah.
Or go back to a world where, you know, she wasn't super happy. She ran away from her own wedding. She has a line. She's like, I hate parties, and wedding parties are the worst.
Wow.
So,
well, that really is, you know, it took a couple of thousand years for people to ask what she thought, right?
Oh, yeah. We relegate some of these characters to kind of second-tier status, and instead it's just, you know, we need to look at our world and to make them relevant, look at it from all of the characters' point of view.
This play goes off into some abstract places, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, you know, what does it ask of the audience?
Well, that's why I think, you know, I think you can kind of talk about it as visual poetry. It has images like a raining elevator, you know, and that is the river. It has characters like the Lord of the Underworld, who you would not expect to be the Lord of the Underworld.
Is this the nasty person?
Well, Des Gilla plays two characters, the nasty, interesting man who kind of helps Eurydice die,
uh-huh.
and then the Lord of the Underworld. And it's kind of, up to interpretation. Is it the same person? Is it two separate people? The Lord of the Underworld is more like a child on a tricycle in this version. Then there are the stones, a chorus of stones. So it's kind of like the old Greek chorus. And those three represent the dead, you know, and that's what they kind of keep telling Eurydice is, you know, stop doing that, just be dead.
So they have a little bit of that Greek chorus commenting on the action
mm-hmm.
function.
Yeah.
Except
yeah.
they're stones.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they also are antagonists within it, too. And in Greek chorus, they're not usually kind of that big of a player.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a whole different approach to theater involved in creating this play, I would think.
Yeah, I think Sarah Rule has her own style, and it's really, really difficult to get a handle on, both I think as a director and as an actor. Alex did the play before, so I think he was, you know, perfectly situated to kind of go, okay, this is what I want to do with it. This is my vision for it. In terms of acting, it can be difficult. It reads deceptively simple. But what is underneath all of those words, just like poetry, I like to kind of describe it as if Horton Foote and Samuel Beckett had to write a play together about the underworld, what would happen?
Two very different playwrights.
Yeah.
and an audience that needs to be aware that they're going to be seeing something that isn't three acts and let's get out of here.
No, exactly. It's there is no intermission, and it is 90 minutes long, and you know, I think there are moments that just whiz by, and then there are moments that just take time. And Sarah Ruhl puts it in her stage directions. She's like, he builds a house. It takes time to build a house. And so, you know, there are these moments where we let the play just kind of breathe, too. And then there are all of the other very, very dramatic moments, like when he does look back at her.
It takes a certain amount of courage to let any kind of action breathe on the stage.
Yeah. It's one of those, you know, as actors, we're like, we have to be doing something all the time. But again, that's the Horton Foote kind of style is just be, trust it. It is powerful, powerful stuff.
It sounds great. Thanks very much, Paul.
Oh, thank you.
Paul Maitre is producer of and performs as the father in Eurydice, the play by Sarah Ruhl, be performed the next two weekends with a Sunday matinee at the Paul and Vailu Theater on the Hawaii Pacific University campus in Kaneohe. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Growing up can be a little bit scary and weird.
On the next Fresh Air, Bo Burnham, writer and director of the new film Eighth Grade, about a girl with social anxiety who makes YouTube videos about how to be confident and make friends. Burnham became a YouTube sensation when he was a teenager and YouTube was still new. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, a live in-studio performance from Eli 3.0.
Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line, record your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us more tomorrow with more of The Conversation.